On the line now, we've got sports management expert. I was calling him a sports psychologist, but that's wrong. He is a sports management expert, and his name is Matthew Scholes. Matt, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now, let's start from the beginning. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your path into sports management?
Sure. So I initially studied science, actually, at Melbourne Uni, which has nothing to do with sports, and then moved into teaching. So I was actually a chemistry teacher initially. But I was also at Melbourne Uni involved. I was president of the Sports Association, involved in the basketball club and maths club. So I started to realise sports management was a career you could do. So then I went back and did sports management as well and studied that course, and then ended up working at Athletics Victoria. And worked there for a number of years, ended up being the CEO of Athletics Victoria. And then I moved on to Hawthorne Footy Club as a marketing manager there. But I remained on, I moved on to the board of Athletics Victoria, which I stayed on for 7 years. And then I moved over to Swinburne, where I did some sports management lecturing. So I sort of combined the original teaching career with the sports management I'd done, which was really quite exciting. And then from there, I sort of alternated between a bit of education and sports management, various projects, working on things like the Swimming World Championships, Commonwealth Games projects. And, at the moment now, I work at AFL Sports Ready as Director of Education. I'm also Vice President of Victorian Commonwealth Games Association. And I also still do research at La Trobe University as a visiting scholar there. And that's where I get into that sports psychology type component.
So you've done a lot in sports management and obviously sports psychology, but did you ever get time to play sport as like a high school or uni student?
Yeah, at university I played basketball and athletics and did cross country and represented the university in all three of them. I still run a bit, still do athletics, track and field, and still play a bit of basketball.
Now, over the past few years, you've developed this positive sports coaching program. Can you tell us a little bit about how this came about?
Yeah, sure. So it's really not a program as such, but I suppose you need to take a step back and say, okay, what it's based on is positive psychology. And positive psychology is a new branch of psychology that's probably been around about 15 years, give or take. And probably the person most people have heard about would be Martin Seligman from University of Pennsylvania, who has written a lot of books like Flourish. And positive psychology's basic aims are to help people flourish rather than just survive in society. So it's a proactive approach to psychology where we look at building people's strengths and looking at the how we can change people's brains so that when they deal with difficult times, their brain doesn't go into a depressive or anxious state where you'd need to see an ordinary psychologist. So it's a different branch of psychology, and it's really exciting. And I'd read a bit about that and been interested in it, but it came about that a school, St. Peter's College in Adelaide, was implementing positive psychology throughout the school, and one of the areas they wanted to put it into was in sports. And what they found was no one's done it. So no one in Australia, no one in the world has really put positive psychology into the sports program. And so they approached me because I was involved in sport and I had a little bit of interest in positive psych, and I did some research and found there's heaps of research on positive psychology in sport, heaps of data, but no one had ever sort of put it together to sort of be able to help coaches use that data to frame the way they coach. So I ended up developing my own thing, positive sports coaching, as a way of framing coaching. So I don't really tell coaches how to coach because they're the experts in their sports and their area, but I give them the research and the information and try and help them frame their coaching in a way that is going to build the well-being of the athletes. And I show them the data to link that when you have high well-being, you also have high performance, and especially performance under pressure. And so from my point of view, I'm looking for well-being of athletes, and I suppose at elite-end sport, they're really looking for performance. And by marrying the two up, it works really well.
So you, so all this research had already been done, and you came along and put it into practice.
Yeah, so,
sounds pretty easy, actually.
so there's a lot of research in different areas of sport and then different areas of positive psychology in schools and in management, and so it was really a matter of looking at that data and that information, and then drawing out some conclusions and also helping coaches draw out their own conclusions from that data. And then I've created a framework for coaches to operate within that doesn't tell them how to coach per se. So it doesn't, I'm not restricting, you know, everyone coaches differently. You'd coach differently than I would, and that's fine. But what I want to do is frame everyone the same way so that we're not overemphasizing negative events. We're getting a balanced view, because everyone has this thing called a negativity bias. And what that is we've evolved, we're evolutionary species, and we've evolved over time, and we've evolved with a negativity bias, of looking for danger. So our subconscious is always looking for danger. And what that means is we have a heightened response to noticing bad things rather than good things.
But that's not a bad thing.
No, that's good for survival. Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. But what it means when you're coaching is that you actually notice the bad things more than you notice the good things. And so you're actually not getting a balanced view of what's happening on the field or in whatever sport you're looking at. And also the athletes themselves have the same negativity bias. So what they do is they notice the bad things they do more than the good things. And what I'm trying to get the coaches to look at is to get a more balanced view. So we're always going to notice the bad things, but we also need to notice the good things and give recognition to that as well, because that's by working on our strengths, we'll actually improve heaps, the data will say, more than if we're just working on our weaknesses. So traditionally, we'd always look at everything we do wrong and try and fix it, and that's fantastic. It's looks really good stuff. What I'm also suggesting is that we also look at what we're doing right and look at improving what we do right as well. And so we're trying to get a balanced view, which is slightly, we actually have to work on your brain. So your brain's neuroplasticity, we know that brains can change and evolve, and by promoting athletes and coaches looking at the positive things they do as well as the negative things, we actually change the brain, the wiring in their brain. And the purpose of that, positive psychology would argue, is by doing that, you actually create the neural connections to enable athletes and players to be more resilient and to be more optimistic, so that when bad things happen, people still feel bad or people feel disappointed, but they're actually able to cope with them and go and move on and perform well still, rather than perhaps dropping into an anxious or depressive event. And so that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to rewire people's brains to deal with bad situations. So positive psychology isn't about looking at all the positives the whole time, nor is it about being happy the whole time. Positive psychology would define happiness as being able to cope with life's negative events as well as enjoy life's positive events. And so we're really looking at dealing with life's negative events, but making sure that we can actually, we feel bad still, but we can cope with them.
But so as a coach, if yep. your player has done, they've been, I guess, man of the match in a footy game, is it better to try and improve their strong points? For example, if they're kicking, they've got 100% kicking efficiency, you can't improve it anymore. Instead, if their handballing efficiency was down at 80%, there's more point looking at their at the negativity of their handballing efficiency rather than trying to promote their kicking efficiency, which is already perfect.
Yeah, a good argument there, except that there's nothing that we can't improve. So, yes, we shouldn't try and improve the things that are weaker. Absolutely. And we do that, and we can't help it. We have a negativity bias. We can't help but try and fix all these things that are not our strengths. But we also know that the research is telling us that when we work on our strengths, we improve twice as much. We move. It's like our brain is pre-wired for our strengths, so it's like a neural superhighway. So you actually improve quicker working on your strengths. That doesn't mean you shouldn't fix the negatives, but it does mean that when you work on your strengths, you'll even improve more, because there is no upper limit. So if you want to be an Olympian, Olympians make the Olympics because they don't see an upper limit. There is no upper limit to how good you can be, but there is an upper limit to removing a weakness. So there's a point where the weakness is gone, and that's as far as you can go. But there is actually no limit to how good you can be, how far your strengths can go. And so I'd argue that we should be working on both. Not that we shouldn't be working on the other, but that we should be working on both. And the reality is that even if we think we are, we don't spend the time on our strengths, and we don't spend the time working out what we're good at. And when we do that, we're creating pre-wiring for mental health as well, which is really important.
Now, I read on, I've looked at your website, and the positive sports coaching method or theory, it's taken off all around the world. I saw a comment of on your website from a Major League Baseball player. So where else has this method taken you?
Yeah, look, it is slowly moving around different people. I mean, the amazing thing of websites and stuff is people speak to you from all over the place. I've done presentations in Toronto last year at the Canadian Positive Psychology Conference, and then also earlier this year I went to Los Angeles for the World Congress on Positive Psychology, and actually next year I'm going back to Ottawa in Canada to do a presentation. So, yeah, I do present both in Australia and around the world on this, and get to meet different people. And I do also, obviously, people email me from different parts of the world who are working in similar areas and sort of pass on comments. It is something that's going to, that, you know, I'm only a small fish in a big world of positive psychology and sports industry, but certainly people from different parts of the world have spoken to me.
So,
I was just going to say also the Oceania Olympic Committee are also working with me at the moment to look at bringing this as something that they can work through all the Oceania countries, which will be good.
Oh, not just Australia?
Yeah.
Duh. Anyway, now, if we go a little bit deeper, I read about the four pillars of the positive sports coaching model: the coaches, the athletes, the administration, and the supporters. How do you involve the supporters?
Yeah, maybe I should take a step back and just go through those four pillars, and then I'll lead to the supporters. Might be an easy way to explain it for people listening. The most important pillar, I say, is the coaches. The coach has to be both looking for the positives to counterbalance the fact that they have a negativity bias and they're going to notice the negatives. And then I get them to work through what I call a positive sports coaching wheel. And the coach is the most important pillar. Then I work with the athletes. So if we've got coaches coaching in a particular way, framing the language, then the athletes themselves need to work with that. And I'm very big on athletes respecting themselves, the opposition, their teammates, their coaches. I think respect's really important in that part of it. And also, I say athletes' focus should be, in terms of team sports, on encouraging their teammates, so identifying when their teammates do well, rather than yelling at teammates when they do the wrong thing. I think their biggest focus should be identifying and encouraging teammates when they do well. And the benefit of this is we also at that same time rewire both them and their teammates' brain to look for the positives, and we know there's a whole lot of benefits in having that in both sport but also outside sports life. So we've got these two pillars. The third pillar is an interesting one. So what I identified was if you've got the coaches and athletes on board, the next inhibitor is actually the administration of the sport, and it depends on the structure of your sport. There's a number of different ways we can talk about administration, but generally speaking, what it means is if your board and the management team aren't on board in this way we're coaching, what it can mean is a coach could come out and be not want to give the players a spray, want to work with the players on their strengths, and the team could be losing. The team could be, you know, having a bad season. If the board and the CEO are putting pressure on coaches to, you know, give them an old-fashioned spray, scream at the players, that sort of thing, that's really counter. It breaks up what the coaches are doing, and it actually breaks down the system we're trying to put in place. So what we next need to do is to get the administration on board. We've also identified with a lot of research that the way that organisations talk about their team links back to how they perform under pressure. So they've done some studies in the United States where they've looked at the Major League Baseball teams and the whole league, and then they've looked at the newspaper articles where people, coaches and administrators, talk about the sport. And all they've done is cut out every newspaper article, 15,000 of them, where a team has, or a player from a team or a management of a team has actually talked about their team, so direct quotes. What they then did is categorise teams into teams with positive or optimistic explanatory styles and teams with pessimistic explanatory styles. Then they ran that against performance over the next season. And what they found was just from the way the administrators and the staff talk about an elite baseball team, under pressure, the teams with the optimistic explanatory styles won. And they had a academic definition of under pressure. But also, they all finished higher than they should have compared to the list that they had. So what we're finding is just the way you talk about your team becomes really important. So what I talk to organisations about is the way you present information in annual reports, in newsletters, on websites, the way CEOs and staff talk about the teams, how they frame losses. Because sports, sometimes you're going to win and sometimes you're going to lose, and that's just the fact in sport. But it's how you cope with those losses that dictates the performance of your season. So once we got those three pillars in place, we then looked at what else is going to affect this. And what we found was that it's supporters. Now, we define supporters as either the traditional member supporter or friends, family and parents. Now, parents are the great strengths of any sporting organisation, but also sometimes the great challenge. And so what we've started to do, and this is the answer to your question, is what we've started to do is work with different sporting groups and also with parents to try and get them to reframe the way that they define a win and a loss and a performance. One of the things we're doing with parents that's been very successful is getting them to ask their son or daughter, what were the five best things you did in the game? So rather than saying, did you win? Did you lose? How many goals did you kick? Saying, what were the five best things you did in the game? And what that happens is you start a conversation that broadens what success is. And I think that's really important to start that conversation. But it also then starts to reframe wins and losses. We're still trying to win, but we have to frame losses in such a way that our performance doesn't drop the next week. Now, with supporter groups, so what we'd be looking to do there is to work with the way we communicate with supporters, encouraging them to explain that if they support in a positive way, their team will perform better under pressure, and work with supporters to sort of understand that. So I think we've seen in a number of sports over the last 12 months that if a team's losing, people spitting on coaches and players, swearing at them, that's not supporting, in my view. And so my view would be that stuff just, it doesn't help team performance, it's not going to help the team the next week, and it's inappropriate. In fact, I have a theory that if things are inappropriate in the workplace or in a social setting, they shouldn't be in sport. And sometimes we seem to let behaviours that are inappropriate creep into sport. So working with supporters is probably the least important pillar, but we do that mainly through engagement, either directly with them or via internet.
But going through all this, I guess, having that little bit of negativity in sport, doesn't that make the participants or the athletes stronger in themselves? If you take all that away, then if you're like, a metaphor would be if you throw a stick and a stone at them, then they're just going to crumble. Or if you throw words at them, they're just going to crumble. But isn't all this, like, from the supporter pressure and then the pressure from the coaches, doesn't that make the player better as well?
That would be your theory, but practice doesn't seem to bring that out. All the data is saying that performance under pressure is about having an optimistic explanatory style. So the way coaches coach. So firstly, I'll just be clear, I'm not proposing that we be positive all the time. We still understand when we're doing things wrong, when things don't go well. But what we look at that is we make sure that's contextualised, and we make sure we deal with that in an appropriate way, and we don't overemphasise those negative moments. But we still deal with the negatives, and one of the things I like to do is to frame that negative with an optimistic explanatory style. So rather than always opening with what's going wrong, open with what's going right, and then talk about what's going wrong, but we're certainly not ignoring the positive. So it's not a super positive environment. So what we're doing in doing that, and the science backs this up, is we're actually building resilience and optimism. And if we build this resilience, then your argument that, you know, if people are then yelling at them or speak to them on the field, they're going to be less resilient. It's just not, doesn't back it up. What actually happens is we build this resilience and optimism. But it isn't in a positive environment in the sense that we're not ignoring negative states or negative things that have happened. We're still dealing with them, but we're not overemphasizing them. We've got to get a balanced view. And the fact that we have a negativity bias means that we tend to overemphasize the negatives and forget about the positives. And it's really valuable for us to sit back and enjoy good moments, to recognize when we've done great things, and to think about how that feels. Because when we do things right and we think about it, that's the thing we want to do, and that's what we want our body to remember. We want to have an imagery of doing it right, swinging the golf club when it felt perfect. They're the moments we have to remember. We'll also be looking to fix things, but knowing the thing when it's right is even more important. So, but also from your resilience point of view, the way I'm proposing coaching builds resilience and optimism, so that people under pressure win more games, perform better, don't drop performance. And so, yeah, although it may seem like that, it isn't changing so much what we do. It's just probably making sure we get a balanced view.
Now, I read that we'll call it the PSC because it's a long,
yep.
It's a long three words. The PSC is about combining improved performance with well-being, which is what you mentioned. What was the common coaching technique previously?
I'm not sure there was a particular. I don't know that I'm providing a particular coaching technique, nor do I think there is a previous coaching technique. But what I would say is, because we have a negativity bias, primarily what we do in coaching generally is try and fix weaknesses. And, you know, it's a totally logical thing to do, and it's great, and it's really important. In fact, I was speaking at a Cricket Victoria coaching course earlier this year, and the session after me was identifying weaknesses in bowling. But what is interesting is we don't have a session saying identifying correct technique in bowling. And so that's really what I'm arguing, is that we're not balancing it out. So what's the technique now? Look, there's a lot of really great stuff going out there, don't get it wrong, but there is a tendency to try and always look to fixing faults, and I'm arguing that we should also be looking at strengths and identifying strengths and understanding what the strengths are.
Now, and we see quite a few athletes go through depression in retirement, but also some while they are actually competing. Is the PSC more about helping athletes cope away from their, helping them being able to cope away from their sporting lives?
Look, positive psychology generally has been shown to help people fend off or depression and anxiety. And if we're talking percentages, the Australian Bureau of Statistics says that 26% of 16 to 24-year-olds had a mental disorder in the past year. So if you think of that, that's one quarter of every team has some kind of mental disorder, primarily depression or anxiety. So these are things that your brain's just not coping with life's negative effects. Now, that could be a sporting matter, or that could be something outside sport, but either way, if one quarter of your team is having some kind of mental disorder, you're not performing at your optimal level. So, yes, I think that the way I'm arguing that we should coach is going to help athletes both in and out of their sport, but in their sport as well. And when we talk about athletes going through depression, you know, they're on those percentages. They're massive percentages of people suffering from depression, whether they're athletes or not. Sports people aren't immune from the same thing that's happening in society. In fact, sport's a high-pressure environment at every level. It's fantastic and terrific for people, and it helps build great levels of well-being, but it also doesn't mean that people aren't going to be prone to depression and anxiety. So I think we've got to be really aware of that when we're coaching, that coaches have a huge influence on players for the rest of their lives at every level, and that they have a, whether they want it or not, they have a responsibility for the mental well-being of their players. And so, yeah, I'm arguing that the way we coach needs to ensure that athletes are able to cope with their life and with their sport. But in doing so, it's completely logical that if 25% of your players having a mental disorder and you can stop that happening by the way you coach and the way you train their brains to think, then your team's going to perform better.
So how many athletes, is it a matter of how many athletes you've tested this this theory on in order to perfect it and be confident in the results? Or how did you do the research to be confident in it?
So firstly, there's research, international research, on different aspects that I use to look at the data, to look at how we should coach things. And then there's international research on positive psychology and its outcomes. And so I'm drawing a lot of that together. And then what I've done is we've run a couple of different pilot studies. We went one with these athletes in soccer and football, school-aged athletes, so at high end, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. And we ran a study there, and we had a look at their pre and post going through this program, how their well-being was, how they felt. And we looked at both their negative states and their positive emotions. It's called a PANAS study, but I won't go into the technical details of it. But basically what we found was that after they've gone through training in positive sports coaching, we found that, and these were reasonably happy athletes, I might say, they moved up about 14% in their well-being stats, and their negative emotions didn't change. They held steady. So we were pretty encouraged by those results. And we're now looking at doing a longitudinal study on that one and also looking at team performance. We've also done a study with the coaches, and we covered a whole range of sports, six different sports, badminton, cricket, rowing, tennis, track and field, volleyball and water polo. And we looked at both the athletes and the coaches there. And what we found, which was really interesting from the coaches' point of view, was that their actual confidence in their coaching ability increased after going through the program, which was not entirely expected. Their well-being also increased significantly, which was great. And they really came out, we did a deductive thematic analysis, and what we found, there was five key themes that came out that they found through this program, was that they started to communicate better with their athletes. They were better at giving feedback. They had a heightened awareness of their actual coaching, so they sort of got a sense of what coaching was and how they really got a sense that they were coaching really well. And then their fourth theme was that they realised they weren't emphasising positives enough, and then they started to do that. And when they did that, they started to actually notice more. So we're actually blind to things on the field, and so they started to notice more. And the last one was that they actually thought that they started to target, they felt like their coaching techniques were improved because they were able to target people more appropriately. So we've done a couple of pilot studies like that. We've presented in academic conferences, and we're going to do some longitudinal studies now to look at some other areas of performance. But the data is really promising. And it's also some interesting data coming out of it. So what we're finding is that basically coaches don't see half the game. So when we get them to look at footage of their teams and note down what they notice, they might notice 10 things, 5 positive, 5 negative. It seems pretty normal. But when we get them to look at it again and just look for positive things, they might find another 30 positive things that they hadn't seen. And the thing about that is that's 30 learning situations that they're not noticing. But once you train your brain to notice those things, you're getting a better perspective of your athletes. And what we're finding is that coaches are starting to notice the middle-level athletes. The athletes, they tend to notice the elite athletes and the poor performers because they really stand out for you. But then the 80% of athletes in the middle, they don't notice much. And what they're finding is that they're playing people in wrong positions, that people have different skills that they even realised, and they just didn't realise they're not seeing it. And so it's really interesting as they start to train themselves to look for these, to look for good things that are happening as well as bad things, they're actually noticing more, and they're giving themselves more opportunities to teach their athletes. So we've got a couple of pilot studies across areas that we're quite confident with is showing some really good results. But like everything, we'll continue to do more longitudinal research to have a look at it. But our latest preliminary data on performance that's coming through is that after a three-year period, I think in one of the studies we looked at the athletes, we improved their well-being, then we looked at the coaches and their well-being improved. And in the third year, which we're looking to present soon, the performance of the teams improve remarkably. So once you create this positive organisation, what you find is you start to win all the close games, and the close games define a season. So you hold your performance at your normal level. It doesn't drop over the season, which has been quite exciting, but we haven't published that data yet. But it's all looking really positive.
Have you thought about taking this into the business world? Like, why would you just restrict to the sporting world when it could improve everybody?
Look, the positive psychology is all around the world in a whole lot of areas. I think most of the major companies in the United States would use positive psychology. I know the whole US Army are being trained in positive psychology, which is a lot of people. Adelaide itself, the whole city of Adelaide is becoming a positive, I think South Australia in fact is becoming a positive psychology state, and they're spending a lot of money to train all their people in positive psychology across a whole lot of areas. So a lot of schools across Australia using positive psychology, like in Victoria, Kingswood College, Peninsula School, Carey Grammar, Ivanhoe Grammar, schools that are doing positive psychology now. So it's really spreading. So the answer is I'm not really restricting myself. I suppose I'm working in a niche that other people aren't that keen to work in. And, but I do some work with businesses, and I have, again, using sport as the metaphor in that context. But I still sort of still stay in my area of strength, which is sport. But we're finding some good results, to be honest. Some of the organisations really enjoy talking about an organisation in terms of the management staff being the coaches and the staff being the players. And we use that sort of concept and makes it a little bit more fun and maybe a little less confronting. And so we can get some really good changes going on there. So I have worked with a number of businesses, but my primary focus is probably in the sports area.
Now, you touched on this a little bit before. It's not an all-positive environment, but does having an increased positive environment in a sporting team reduce the athlete's ability to take criticism from coaches or even worse, from supporters in the audience? I know you touched on that a little bit earlier.
Yeah, look, it's a tricky one, isn't it? My answer is no, but we've got to get a... what I would say is that the athletes are going to be intensely critical of themselves. So they're always being critical of themselves. What we're trying to build is this optimism and resilience in them so they can take... when negative things happen, supporters yell at them, coaches yell at them, they are more resilient to that. What I would say is that coaches probably don't need to yell at people in an attacking way. So you can yell at people in a motivational way. I'm all for that, but when we're attacking individuals, we're probably not teaching them because their brains basically switch off. We drop into what's called amygdala hijack. And what that means is we move into fight or flight mode. We get huge amounts of adrenaline go through us. Our brain stops operating at its optimum level. So normally we can think of about 7 plus or minus 2 things. When we go into amygdala hijack, our brain operation shrinks. And we're not thinking because we're basically deciding, do we have to run or fight? So when someone attacks us, that's what happens. So we're not even thinking properly. So coaches, when they're yelling at people, aren't thinking properly. So they're not operating at their best. And players who are being yelled at aren't thinking properly, so they haven't learned anything. So you're not actually teaching anyone. So, yeah, look, I'm not sure that people become less resilient because they're not being yelled at. I think people are resilient, generally speaking, and the supporters could still be screaming at people. And there's always a challenge in that area. But I don't think it would make people less resilient for them not to be screamed at by coaches. That would be my argument. And look, it doesn't happen much now. Look, coaching's changed a lot. The real challenge is that coaching is an emotional and high-pressure role, whether you're a volunteer or whether you're a paid professional. And what that means is that under pressure, it's not really the day-to-day coaching, which people I think now know that you shouldn't really be screaming at athletes is not really going to help. But under pressure, it's really hard to not let yourself drop into that amygdala hijack, not drop in the point where you're not thinking clearly because you're so upset, angry or anxious. And so that takes training. And so that's why I've created a sort of a structure or model for athletes, for coaches to follow, so that under pressure, they'll still go through the right motions and they'll still keep their brain clear and they'll still be thinking as clearly as possible, because that's really important, because coaching is really teaching and we need to be able to stay clear-minded and think it through. We can still be passionate, we can still try and motivate people, we can still raise our voices, but in an appropriate and encouraging manner rather than in an attacking or demeaning manner.
Yeah, you should have visited my primary school teachers when I was in primary school. Jeez.
look at, you know, coaching's changed, and it's changing now, and you see it in a lot of the coaches now. They're a lot more thoughtful and a lot more professional, but again, it's, we grew up in a time when, you know, coaches, we watched on TV, coaches screaming at players and doing those things, and so, you know, from a parent-coach sort of environment and those primary school coaches, that's an area I'm really keen to change, because if we can give them the information and the knowledge, then people realise that that's not what you need to do. But often people are just mirroring what they grew up with, because that's how, you know, that's all we know.
Does your program have does the program have an aspect on how to deal with banter from opposition players, and which has obviously become bigger and bigger in the AFL with a few notable offenders like Stephen Millen, who has retired, and also Hayden Ballantyne from Fremantle? Does it have an aspect on how you can, whether you fight back or I guess fight or flight when you're being heckled by an opposition player?
Probably that's more the realm of a sports psych who deals with individual athletes. I'm dealing more with the broader stuff, but I think we've seen with the cricket team as well that, you know, sledging is quite big. I'm of the view, generally speaking, that it is not going to necessarily help your performance. Certainly, if you're resilient and you've got an optimistic explanatory style, you're less likely to be drawn into those sorts of things if someone's trying that to sort of put you off. I am of the view, though, that if it's not appropriate in the workplace or in a social setting, it's probably not appropriate on a sporting field. And I'm not entirely sure that there's huge amounts of benefit from it from a sporting point of view. Often you're putting yourself off, spending your time bantering. Though some people are very good at it, I suppose. But, I think that I don't specifically cover those areas, but I do believe that if you're resilient and you've got an optimistic explanatory style, that sort of stuff's just going to wash over you and not disrupt you from your game. Where if you're less resilient, you're going to be more affected by that sort of thing.
I guess it's all about your performance. If you're playing better than them, then nothing they can say is going to affect you.
Yeah, look, I think so. But also, it's the way you frame what's happening in the field and your performance and other people's comments. The way your brain processes that is really important, and that builds your resilience. So if someone's saying something to you, trying to put you off, but it doesn't, the way you process it doesn't make it affect you, or you don't even listen to them because it doesn't, you don't think it's true, or you don't think that you, just because you drop the ball or something, and then they start talking to you about how you dropped the ball in a cricket game, drop a catch, if you process that as that's a once-off, you know how to catch, next time you'll catch it, you will. But if you aren't resilient, you don't have those processes in place, you drop a catch and then you start to have doubts, and then someone says things, then probably they're just drawing at your own doubts anyway.
Now, a well-noted incident of recent where banter has been involved is the girl in the crowd screaming at Adam Goods. Now, we don't know what she said, but Adam Goods obviously pointed it out. Would you recommend that they pointed it out, or would you just recommend that they go on with their with the game? Like, what's the difference in these brain functions between players, whether they point it out or they just keep going on and ignore it?
I think that's a different situation. I think racism is something that is a crime actually in Australia, isn't it? And it's and I think that Adam was pointing out someone who is doing the wrong thing. He's really sticking up for his Aboriginality, I would imagine, and I don't think that's got anything to do with sport, to be perfectly honest. I think that's
that's not a psychology thing.
Sorry,
it's not even classified as a psychology thing.
Oh, look, it could be. I don't think. I my view on that is that that Adam was probably standing up for the thousands of Aboriginals in Australia who put up with racist comments, taunts, and disadvantage across Australia. And I think doing it in a public setting is probably a good thing for his people. And so, he should be proud of himself, and I'm sure the girl involved learned a lesson, and I'm sure that many people in the community have learned a lesson to see that this sort of stuff is just inappropriate. Things that happened, people would think was appropriate 50 years ago, just people have realised now they're not.
Does the increased use of the PSC method in sport and the era of the classic coach spray, as made famous by Ron Barassi, and more recently when Mick Malthouse was at Collingwood, or Lee Matthews or Kevin Sheedy, they're all famous for doing big sprays at halftime or at quarter time. Does this kind of end that tradition in sport?
Yes, in a sense. Look, that would be my, you know, my, if you're out there telling people they're hopeless, they're stupid, they're idiots, and screaming at them, if you're calling that a spray, then yeah, that should just never happen. It's just inappropriate, and it's not going to motivate anyone or make them play better.
But 30, 40 years ago, that was the coach of a premiership team.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, I'll just clarify before, because I agree with that. You're not going to, firstly, if you're talking Brass, you're not going to, he's a great coach, and I don't think he would say that when he was screaming like that he was at his best coaching. I don't know, but it depends what you're saying. If he's out there ranting and raving, but he's saying motivational things, he's saying, remember what we talked about at training, remember what we're meant to do in the back line, remember to do this, and saying things to do and positive things, and he's not attacking individuals, that's fine. It's fine to be screaming and raving as long as you're not attacking individuals, because that's motivational. And so that sort of spray is fine. But I think if you're out there telling people, you know, that they're hopeless and they're this sort of thing, well, I don't think that's appropriate, and I don't think that builds team performance either in that moment nor over a season, because what we find is that those messages become harder and harder to take for players, and that's when coaches' messages become stale. So, yeah, look, my view would be that those sorts of things have changed over time, and that even if people are emotional as coaches and they're out there in what's seen to us when we're looking on TV like they're really going off, they're probably saying more motivational stuff and educational stuff rather than attacking people. They're probably telling people what they need to do and how to do it rather than saying, you're an idiot for dropping the ball or whatever. So I think the things have changed. And I think also we remember these sprays when they're probably, you know, 1% of the times the coaches talk to players. Just that they're very theatrical and they go end up on YouTube and that sort of stuff.
Is there a level to which a voices coach can be raised that no matter what they say, the players are just fighting or flighting, or they're in the fight or flight mode, and they're just ignoring it?
I don't think so. Look, I think if you're not attacking the players, if you look at some of the American coaching stuff, it's really loud, it's really over the top, but it's all motivational, and the players leave pumped. And that's what really coaches normally do, they're doing that sort of stuff. I think I don't think it's the volume that's important, it's the intent. If you're out there because you're just angry and you're frustrated, and coaching is an angry and frustrating game, and if you let that show too much and you show people, you know, you start attacking someone who's made a mistake, then that isn't good. I don't think it's good for the player either. People know they've made a mistake, and you know, no one goes out there intending to make a mistake in a game of any sport. Every player goes out there trying their hardest, but people do forget game plans and the emotion of the game. People do make mistakes. People make poor decisions, and they do need to be reminded of that, but it needs to be in a positive, well, it needs to be framed in an optimistic way.
Now, there's a few more questions before we finish up. I read about the positive sports coaching wheel, which you developed to explain the method. Does there come a time when a coach can be too positive and they start to sound fake?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm actually quite an opponent of people doing that as well. So if we go to junior sport, we tend to say everything's great. Great job. Everyone play great. You're all done it great. If it's not genuine and it's not real, it's not coaching. And so if you go to the kids' sport...
This is good.
So the kids, when we're coaching kids, it's if you say they've done something right, it's got to be specific and it's got to be real, so that you're actually teaching them. You can't just say, "Oh, great job, everyone." So my coaching wheel, we talk about what went well. Then we talk about specific things that individuals have done. So, I don't know, Tim, great job, you centered it off the wing. That's what I want everyone to do. Now, if you say something like that, a positive thing, like, you know, Tim, I want you, you've centered it off the wing into the forward line just like I wanted, even if no one else had done it all game, if you use Tim as the example, everyone else will hear that message. If you say to everyone, you've hardly been centering it off the wing and I've been asking you that, people won't hear that message, but they love to hear, subconsciously people want their name. So what we do is we identify things that people have done well that are real and they're specific, and we process praise them for that. Then we list the things that are going wrong. But you don't need to name individuals. You know, number five's running loose in the centre, the back line's not talking enough, whatever those things are. And then we talk through in the wheel. We talk about, remember what we talked about at training. 90% of the things that in a game we're talking about, we've actually covered in training. People are just forgetting. So I like to use the word remember. And then I just like the coaches to say, so this is what I want you to do, and then we go back to these are the things you're doing well. So we move through a wheel. It's just a circle. But why we do that is that coaches start to train themselves to always follow this process. It only takes 4 to 6 seconds, but if they always go through this process, when it becomes tense or under pressure, just like when we train an athlete to practice and practice so that under pressure they'll perform the physical activity correctly, we're doing the same things with coaches. We're training them to speak and go through the process correctly every time so that under pressure they'll still do that. And that's what the wheel's about, is giving coaches a structure. And we found it really simple for coaches to use. It works for individual sports and team sports, and it's adapting to different styles of coaches. So coaches coach their own way, but it's just giving them a way to frame it so that they help to build the optimism and resilience of players.
Now, I keep using AFL as an example, but that's the easiest sport to relate to here in Australia. When there's a quarter time or a half time break, the coaches are all coming to a huddle with the players. The head coach will usually give a message, and then they all split up into the forward line, into the ruck, into the midfield, into the defence. Now, what happens if the messages don't match up between the assistant coaches in their specific areas and the senior coach? Does that create a problem?
Well, that's probably not really...
Or the techniques of each coach.
What I'm talking about, but yes, obviously any sort of disjoint in messaging is a problem in coaching.
I guess not the message, more of the technique.
Across all their coaches, and that's how you create a coaching team. Because if you've got one coach saying a different thing to the head coach, whatever, then players are going to be confused and there's going to be those mixed messages. But generally speaking, coaches work really well together as a team and have pretty consistent messages. Then they talk before they come on the field. So I don't think that becomes a major issue.
What about their technique? If they're not confident in what you say, the positive, negative, positive technique, does that create...
Hello?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello? Hello? Are you there, Matt? Matt? Oh, it seems like we've lost Matt. Matt, can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Hold on one sec, listeners. We'll be right back.
Yeah, I can hear you.
You can hear me?
Yeah, what happened?
I don't know. That was weird.
Could you hear me?
Yeah, I could hear you.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I couldn't. Yeah.
So I was just going to say, if the assistant coaches aren't confident in the positive, negative, positive technique, does that create... Can you hear me? Hello? Oh, we seem to have some technical difficulties. Can you hear me, Matt? Matt, come in. I can see you're there. Hello? Hello? Can you hear me, Matt? Hello? Oh, we seem to have lost him. What can I... Oh. Hello? Can you hear me now? Let's try. We have technical difficulties live on the air. This is fun. Now, hello. Matt, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can, yep.
You can hear me?
I couldn't though before, yeah.
Okay, but we're back.
Okay, we're back, yep.
Okay, so... I was going to ask, what if the coaches, the assistant coaches aren't confident in the positive-negative-positive technique? Does that create angst among the players?
Oh, look, I think if you were a coaching team, so I've done a bit of work with Adelaide Footy Club, Adelaide Footy Club earlier this year, and usually speaking, all the coaches would come along to the training and discuss it, and then as a group decide how they're going to use it most effectively. So I think they'd come to group consensus on that rather than individuals choosing their own path. And so from a coaching team's point of view, I think they'd come to their own decision about how much or how little of this they wanted to do and how they wanted to go about it, and that all agree as a team rather than having individuals doing a bit here and there. Because you're right, if half the coaches coach one way and half another, then that's going to be a disjointed message which isn't going to work well.
Now, in your opinion, is there room for improvement in this method?
Well, I suppose I'm only framing coaching, so there's always room to change and to move depending on what research comes out. But based on the research we've got at the moment and based on the analysis and the feedback we're getting from coaches, the basic models seem to work. They're flexible enough to fit around any coach's needs, and it really just gives coaches a framework. So much of my role is to provide them with information and evidence so that coaches can make an informed decision and then a framework to help them operate within. And I'm not really telling coaches something that they intuitively don't know, but I'm really helping them to understand the science behind it and also to give themselves the confidence and self-belief to stick with it under pressure, because that's important.
Now, Matt, it's been a great, great chat today. You've stood up for your research, which is great to see. Where can people find you and learn more about the positive sports coaching method?
Yeah, sure. You can go to my website, www.positivesportscoaching.com.au. I also work in the Level 2 AFL and cricket coaching courses. So in those level courses, people can go through that as well.
So thank you very much for talking to me today, and good luck with your research in the future and for all the new research.
Thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.